Welcome to Trial Lawyer Review, a podcast for and about trial lawyers. We will tell the stories about trial lawyers who go to battle every day in courtrooms throughout the United States for injury victims. This is about their stories and their practices. Hello, everyone. I'm Jason Lazarus, your host for Trial Lawyer Review. Thank you for tuning in today for another episode. Trial Lawyer Review is brought to you by Synergy Settlement Services. In full disclosure, I'm not a professional podcaster. Instead, my day job is Chief Executive Officer of Synergy Settlement Services. Synergy allows trial lawyers to focus on what they do best by handling the difficult issues that arise at settlement, like troublesome lien resolution issues, Medicare secondary payer compliance, government benefit preservation techniques, and complex settlement planning.
Joining me today on Trial Lawyer View is Brett Turnbull. He's a very talented trial lawyer and founder of Turnbull, Holcomb, and Limone, PC in Birmingham, Alabama. Hopefully I got that last name correct. His practice focuses on representing the severely injured all across the United States. He's got a pretty large bio, so I'm going to read a bit to you guys so you get a little bit of an understanding of Brett's background. He's got more than a decade of successful courtroom experience in complex litigation, including truck cases, products liability, automotive defects, pediatric burns, traumatic brain injury, and nursing home malpractice. He's licensed in 4 states and has taken 70 jury trials to verdict. In the last few years alone, he's received jury verdicts of $21.5 million, $9 million, and $5 million in product liability and medical malpractice cases. When he goes before a jury, he realizes he has one job, to get justice for his client by proving their claims and guiding the jury to award a fair and reasonable verdict. Brett has won national recognition for his trial advocacy skills. That leadership track continued throughout his legal career. Today, he gives back to his profession by serving in leadership positions with the Alabama Association for Justice, Alabama State Bar, and Southern Trial Lawyers Association. Brett received his undergraduate degree from the University of Alabama, so I assume he's a Roll Tide fan, and his JD from Cumberland School of Law, Samford University. He is AV preeminent rated by Martindale Hubbell, recognized by the National Trial Lawyers as a top 40 under 40 trial lawyer and a super lawyer. Brett, welcome on to Trial Lawyer Review.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. I really appreciate it.
So before we get into the meat of this, let's talk a little bit of personal stuff. So are you an Alabama fan?
I am. I grew up an Alabama fan all the way through. So it was pretty easy. I finished school at Alabama and have been a fan ever since. I take my son to games and we have a big time.
Well, it's been fairly easy of late, I think, to be a Bama fan, considering all the success. I went to Florida State for law school and was there when they won their first national championship, and they had a pretty good run after that. And since then, it's been, since Bobby Bowden's departure, it's been a rough going. So I'm envious that you've got that team to root for, because their success is pretty incredible.
It's been an amazing ride. You know, when I was in college there, we weren't very good. So it's been a lot of fun since.
Yeah, I went to UCF undergrad, and UCF's had a pretty amazing rise to national prominence. And remembering when I was there, when they were Division I AA and playing schools you'd never heard of, to now going to games and, you know, us playing big names and beating Auburn a few years ago in the Sugar Bowl, or no, Peach Bowl. Pretty awesome to see that, change over time from basically obscurity to national prominence. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, anytime Auburn gets beat, I'm happy. That's
great. Yeah, I figured that would be a good thing for you, right? So I know that you've got 4 kids and cherish your family time. I'm curious, how do you balance a busy trial practice and working on cases all over the country with your family life?
Well, you know, it has been difficult at times. Obviously, it's not always easy. But I can tell you that my primary commitment was to when I am in Birmingham with my family, to really try to be there, be present, and realize that, you know, when I'm away, there's only so much I can do about that. But, you know, what I try to do is make sure I don't come home and then sort of work the whole time then too. That's the big thing.
I guess now with technology too, it's a little bit different. You know, I remember, you know, in the past it was harder to connect with your family when you're out of town or on the road. Now with Zoom, you know, you get that opportunity that you used to not get. My son graduated last year from college and has moved out to Austin. So now, you know, we connect using FaceTime. It's nice being able to have that technology connection that, you know, in the past you just had a phone call, and now you can actually, you know, interact over video. It's kind of nice to get that.
Yeah, it's changed things for sure. It's also changed the necessity for travel because of all the things we do with litigation differently, for sure.
Yeah. Well, so I wanted to talk with you about how you wound up going to law school, since I noticed your undergraduate majors were not your typical pathway to law school. What made you decide to go to law school? And then after you graduated from law school, how did you decide to make plaintiff personal injury trial law your career?
Well, I admit my reason for going to law school is not a very good one. I was actually going to do international finance. And at the time I was coming out of college, I took a job in Germany. I majored in German as well, and with the largest accounting firm in the world. And they went under right after I took the job. And so I took the last bar exam they let me take, and frankly just had to regroup and consider law school like a 3-year opportunity to do that. And look where everything ended up.
Yeah. And so then how did you decide once you graduated from law school to get into plaintiff personal injury law and make that your life's work?
Yeah, I mean, obviously early on, I figured out that trial was something that I enjoyed. During law school, I had an opportunity to work at some firms over the summers and kind of figure out what I didn't want to do. And, you know, honestly, had an opportunity to work for a prominent personal injury firm here in Birmingham, and basically I just got to know some clients during the course of the summer and see how it was affecting their lives. And, you know, that coupled with the opportunity to try cases, which is what I enjoy doing, led me straight into plaintiff's work. And I've done it from day one and haven't ever stopped.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. My path to law school was like yours. I didn't intend to go to law school, and I actually went on the advice of an advisor I trusted very much, because I was a psychology major undergrad and really couldn't do anything but go on to grad school. And he suggested, well, maybe think about law school. I think it would be a good fit. And he was right. But, you know, it's funny that you talk about your experiences leading you to the plaintiff side, you know, wanting to go to trial and get that experience. Cause I went to the defense side out of law school, and, you know, for me, it was a lot of grunt work, and you don't really get what you want to get, which is really that experience that you can only get if you're thrown into the fire pretty much on the plaintiff side, because most defense firms take you along pretty slowly, and you're doing a lot of grunt work before you actually get to try a case. So it's kind of cool that you were able to take that path and see that that was what, you know, ultimately you were meant to do.
Yeah, there's no question about it that every day that goes by in your practice, if you're not having an opportunity to get reps and to be in a position where you can, you know, there's no better way to experience it than to do it. Experience is required. It's the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is behind your passion for trial law and being in the courtroom?
Well, to start with, when I began my practice, I would say that my passion for and my reason for being a trial lawyer is because somebody wins and somebody loses. You know, as an athlete, as a part of who I was, it was part of my DNA. And when you wake up in the morning, you know, they always say it's not what motivates you, it's what excites you. And, you know, frankly, the win and loss and the opportunity for every case to be the beginning of a new case and to have an ending was vital. Over time, you know, that's changed dramatically. The more catastrophic my you know, the injuries and the magnitude of the cases in terms of how it affects human beings and my clients, coupled with, you know, the fact that oftentimes they're the underdog, those things just add to it very much. But I would say that the human side at this point in my career is really what drives me, for sure.
That's good. That's a good segue into what I was going to ask you, which is about a quote that I'll read. You said, "The thing that I enjoy most about my job is that I get to take up the part of the underdog and stand up for those who've been wronged. There's more to this job than just money, and that feels good. So I'm curious, you know, what's behind all that? What drives you to help people who have been wronged?
Well, I think about it like this. You know, there are a lot of people who go to work every morning and they're punching the clock, right? I mean, it's, and you know, look, I understand not everyone, we're the lucky ones, right? We're the lucky ones. And by that, what I mean is there are a lot of people who, if they're in finance or in their banking, whatever it might be, if they go to bed with more money than they woke up with, then it was a good day. Look, we're all working for money, of course, right? I mean, we're not doing this all for free. But at the same time, if we have the byproduct of being able to help people that really can't help themselves in the circumstances that they're in, life-altering events, and then to have, you know, folks on the other side who basically did it to them not be willing to be accountable, to be able to change all that is really what's exciting, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you about that idea of being lucky, because you're getting that opportunity to help people who are going through a very tough time come out the other side of it. And that's something that I routinely talk to our team about, since we get a similar opportunity. And having, you know, been in an accident myself and been through all that entails, I do believe firmly in what we do and the good that it brings. So I would like to hear you talk a little bit more about what is most important part of that for you and for your law firm, that opportunity.
It's possibly the greatest opportunity that we can have professionally, that you actually represent someone and take their part when they are unable to help themselves. And the fact that they empower you with that, the fact that they're willing to tap you to be the person that has the opportunity and to do that is, you know, if you really sit down and think about it, especially for these people, again, I, my firm, we believe in all of our cases very much. You know, we're obviously very fortunate that, you know, we have the opportunity to decide what we want to work on, frankly, and I realize that, and I also feel very fortunate for that as well. But with that said, there is such an honor to be in that position. You know, I think maybe as a profession, we take it, you know, as time has gone by, we take that a little bit for granted, or maybe we sort of don't think about the magnitude of the term being someone's counselor or being their representative. You know, stand up in the well of a courtroom when somebody's sitting there in a wheelchair and they don't get the opportunity to talk to the jury. And that's a very powerful thing.
Yeah, it's also something I talk a lot about. Our team is this responsibility and you know, what an opportunity is that we have to improve somebody's life by helping them after they've experienced something catastrophic. I mean, you guys are the catalyst for that, and then we get to piggyback on that by, you know, whether it's reducing a lien, protecting their Medicare eligibility, their Medicaid and SSI eligibility, or helping them put together a plan for their settlement proceeds. All those things are things that really do positively impact people. We actually track the number of lives that we positively impact and keep that as a stat for our team, because our vision is to impact as many lives as we possibly can in a positive way. So like you, I that's such a critical part of, I think, our success, is that we believe in that. Because if you view it more as a job, it's different than when you view it as a mission and a passion, and there's a reason for why you do what you do.
Yeah, I mean, to hit on that point, the reality is that money's not going to bring someone back. It's not going to, you know, there's no time machine, as I always say. You know, I don't have the ability to, unfortunately, to take us back there and fix it. But money's not a big deal till you don't have any, okay? And, you know, for these people who have needs and things that are frankly, just fundamental things in life, you know, I always tell juries that what we really are asking is for them to compensate in a way that equals the difference between what is versus what should have been, right? And, you know, oftentimes that's kind of lost in translation, I think, for all of us. And even though I get it, you know, the only thing we can ask for is money, the fact that we can hand that to you guys, and when I work with you, and know that my client's going to be taken care of and that things are going to be like they should be, and that it doesn't end with me, that it continues on. I mean, that's what this is all about, for sure. I mean, it's what it's all about.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, there's certainly no amount of money that I would trade for the day what I was like the day before my accident to what I am like today, because it definitely is fundamentally life-changing and altering when you suffer injuries that can never be undone. But you know, the system is what it is, and that money, though, does help. It does take care of people instead of them being relegated to maybe, you know, a system that doesn't meet their needs, like a system like Medicaid. And you know, that's where a lot of times, you know, I talk to people that don't really understand our legal system and how it functions, and view people that get millions of dollars as almost lottery winners. And I'm like, you don't understand, you know, somebody that's getting millions of dollars probably has, you know, tens of millions of dollars in future medical expenses alone. Forget about all the pain and suffering, you know, that none of this is a lottery. It is, you know, it's an unfortunate situation that the only way we have to address is financially, and the economic realities of someone that's been seriously injured are very difficult and challenging, because there's never enough money typically in a settlement to cover every dollar that they're going to need. So either way, they're going to need some type of government assistance, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid. So, you know, the idea of lotteries is really abhorrent to me.
It's for people who don't understand. That's the only way. Either they don't understand, or they have some other angle where they benefit from those type of terms. Because I got news for you. There isn't a single person that I've represented in the last 15 years who had a result in compensation that was in the millions of dollars that anybody would trade places for. So for them to say that, you know, I bet if we put a folding table out front, I say this to juries too, you know, I guarantee we wouldn't have any takers, all right? And that's the bottom line. So I totally agree with you. I think it's apparent. I think that it's ridiculous. I think that it's the type of things that, unfortunately, the insurance industry and some of these other, the corporate world have, you know, planted into heads and attempted to sway things. So I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. So from my research, and I know from past discussions, you're with a pretty large, well-known personal injury firm in Alabama before starting your own firm. What's the primary reason for you deciding ultimately to start your own firm, and what is it that attracted you to the idea of having your own firm?
Well, I think as trial lawyers, you know, obviously there are certain characteristics that I think kind of thread through the majority of us. And I think that one of those is entrepreneurial spirit. And, you know, to me, to have the willingness to lose and lose with your client in the way that our monetary deals are structured, at some point in your life, if you know that you're able and that you're capable and you're an entrepreneur at heart, it's just very, I always felt like I would look back on my life and wish that I, you know, that was one of the things that I wished, I believe that I would have wished that I had done if I didn't, okay? And so for me, it was really always in the cards. And, you know, the firm that I left is a fantastic firm. I think the world of them. I still work on cases with them. But it was just something I had to do for me.
I get that completely. My parents are and were entrepreneurs. That's why how we moved to Florida was they opened a business here in Orlando when I was 10 years old, and always thought at some point, you know, I probably would do my own thing, which is what I wound up doing, just because there is something about that and getting to chart a course for yourself that, you know, you can't do in other settings. So completely get that. So I want to switch gears and talk to you a little bit about something that I've asked every single guest that's been on the podcast about, and that's with catastrophic cases. What are the top three things you do to empathize with a client to tell their story to the jury, focusing on what they're left with after being injured? Because I think that you've sort of touched on a little bit, but I'd like for you to elaborate on those key things that help you get across to the jury why they need to rule in favor of your client and compensate them for their injuries.
Three things. Well, The first thing that I will say is that unless your client is able to tell their own story in the event that they're able to, that they're still with us or capable of giving testimony in the case, they have to be prepared in a certain way that, that is a part of the methodology that I believe in. And that's that they have to be, we call it emotional congruence, okay? And what that requires is for them to be able to actually be trained in a way to image things and that are, you know, everything in our mind is stored in pictures and images. That's what one of my very, very good friends taught me, you know, years ago. And the reality is they have to be able to access their memories. They have to be able to access things. And those are oftentimes repressed, right? They're very painful things. You know, the event that took place that changed their life forever or that took their loved one or whatever the case might be. So the first thing is to prepare the witness in a very particular way that allows them the ability to reach back down into those memories and to more or less, unfortunately, you know, we have to kind of dig it up. The second thing is that I like for other people to prepare my witness, okay? And I like to be in the room because it gives me the ability to image with them. It gives me the ability to access with them and to use what we like to call the unconscious processing so that I can be congruent with my own client. Now, why does that matter? That matters because if I'm emotionally congruent with my own client, then it gives me a significant advantage to be emotionally congruent during opening statement, during closing argument, and of course, during the direct examination of my client, all of those things. It gives the ability to basically go in there, but why is all that important? That's important, and this is sort of the third thing, is because if you're in there and the client's in there, then the jury goes in there, and it's physiological. And you know, again, it's not like a golden rule type of thing where you're asking them to imagine. You can't ask them to imagine. That doesn't work anyway, by the way. Just, I mean, telling people to imagine doesn't do it. You use certain just absolutely physiological human different types of things in our brains. And when you go in, the client goes in, they go in with you. And that's how you tell their story.
It's interesting because we try to bring to life for our team client stories. And, you know, since we don't have typically access directly to the injury victim, we will use pictures and accounts and details of what has happened to that person so that people understand, you know, and can empathize and understand the importance of our mission that I talked about. So that was one of the reasons why I started asking that question, because I was curious about, you know, the process that our clients use to get that empathy, but also because it's such an important part about, you know, how we run this company, which is really all about that, being able to try and understand the importance of what we do and how we help people.
I would highly recommend, we can talk about that some more, but I think that having the ability to have the right people videoing, but not just videoing, but also, you know, asking them the questions in a certain way. And, you know, I have trials on CourtView Network, and I think that can be, you know, streamed and watched. And, you know, I think that you'll see that having either the client or the client's family be able to go back in there is an emotionally connect. It connects things in a very emotional way, in a very real way that physiologically affects the listener.
It's a great idea. So I wanted to talk about your results because you've gotten some incredible results, and I wanted to ask about a couple of cases that have defined your career. First, there was a case that I read about in Los Angeles against a car manufacturer after a defect caused a crash, killing your client's wife and two small children. I know how hard it is to go up against a large corporation who's got unlimited resource. I'm curious what the single most important thing about a case like that is, which helped define your career.
Well, from a career defining perspective, I had, you know, this is sort of a personal thing. It's really less about the case, but, you know, obviously it was in Los Angeles, so it was far from home. It was the type of case that the room was full of people, you know, and it was my responsibility to stand up and begin opening statement. I knew from past experiences and from my past results that I could do it, but to do it on that stage with that type of, you know, competition, and to perform in a way that I wasn't just being reactive, I wasn't playing scared, I was nervous because any human being would, it's the natural condition, human condition, but I was able to perform in a way that I was proud of and that I was able to do a great job for my client, at least in my eyes. Basically, to be able to perform under that type of overall pressure was a new thing. And I knew I could do it, but it was nice to be able to actually, you know, stick the landing.
Curious about managing emotions in a case like that. I would imagine, based on just the facts of who was killed in that accident, that there must have been an incredible amount of emotion and also like a heaviness on your shoulders of knowing, you know, what you were having to, you know, tell the jury about and the impact and just all that. I just can't imagine that wasn't incredibly weighty.
Yeah, let's face it, in a case like that, one of the things that you try to block out, it's the same thing I used to do in sports, right? I mean, it's like I didn't want to think about throwing interceptions. I wanted to think about throwing touchdowns, but it's also the human condition to ask yourself, what happens if this goes poorly? Where does that put me? Where does that not just put me, but more importantly, where does it put my client? And, you know, if that's why a lot of cases settle, and I understand why they do, I'm not critical of that. We just didn't have that option in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. Not atypical in a case like that, for sure. The second case that I wanted to ask you about was a case in Alabama where you represented the family of a college student who died as a result of a misdiagnosis in an urgent care clinic. I know medical malpractice cases are typically very tough to litigate, expensive, and also tough to win. So what was special to you about getting that verdict for the family in that particular case?
That case was particularly special, and you know, all my clients are special, but that case was particularly special because it was really hard for me to work on that case because my clients reminded me, like me, she reminded me of my kid, and it was hard, and that was really hard, and it was a notoriously very, very, very difficult plaintiff's venue, and people thought I was crazy for turning down the offers that had been made and trying the case, but I believed in the case and I believed in what we were doing. And I don't know, I guess I could have been told, everybody could have been right and the jury could have come back despite all that against us. But I was really glad that we tried that case actually, because, you know, they lost their 19-year-old daughter, and I don't think they would have, it was almost kind of like they would have never forgiven themselves if they hadn't at least been through that process.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly something to the closure of all of that, with that kind of going through all of that and feeling like you actually did get justice served. You know, that's, I think, one of those important aspects. In certain cases, there are just cases that there is some benefit to go in a trial.
In that case, it most certainly was. You know, kind of going back to the thing we talked about earlier, you know, their daughter wasn't going to be brought back. You know, I hate to say this because anytime a client ever tells me it's not about the money, that kind of worries me, because I think we all know the type. But they said it and they meant it, and you know, and they followed through, and I saw what they went through, and I just, you know, it's one of those that I couldn't help but think about, you know, it being my daughter and my family and my life throughout the entirety of the case. And I still talk to my client, I mean, on a weekly basis. We became friends.
Yeah, not all that unusual. I wanted to ask you about trial structure, because I know you're very passionate about trial advocacy, and I know that it is something that you're passionate about. So what is it and why are you part of it?
Trial structure is a business that I started with five of my friends right before the COVID shutdown. We have all been instructors together. in trial advocacy, and we went out on our own. The business itself is, it has several different functions, one of which is that we do consulting work to prepare witnesses with our methodology. We're brought into cases for the purpose of preparing witnesses, also structuring cases, which is our methodology of how we organize information for opening statement, closing argument, and throughout the trial to most effectively prosecute the case. And then, of course, we also, as a group, put on programs, you know, CLE programs for trial advocacy, and invite lawyers, you know, have lawyers come in, and they bring a real case, and we structure their case throughout the course of the program. But most importantly, you know, I have made a lot of friends that way. I've made a lot of business relationships and co-counsel on a lot of cases after having, you know, an opportunity to teach.
So as one of the instructors for trial structure, what is the top two or three reasons as to why instructing other trial lawyers about trial advocacy is so important to you?
You know, I think of that song, you ever, the country song where the grandfather's got the little girl and they're fishing and she thinks we're just fishing, right? And the grandfather's basically, you know, implying that she didn't understand how much this means to me. So like for me, it's not just the opportunity to give back, that's important. But I learn every time I go, every single time. It also puts me on my feet, which is important. You know, you can't be a jiu-jitsu fighter and not be on the floor all the time rolling around, right? So, I mean, it's just part of the deal, but I really do enjoy it.
So that is a good segue into the next question, which is in your bio for trial structure, it just tickled me. It says you have a Rambo litigation style and like to rip the heart out of the defense's case in the courtroom. Can you talk about that and how you use it successfully to represent your own clients?
Yeah, I saw that you put that in there. I didn't. Somebody took some liberties with my trial structure webpage, I guess. We'll have to talk about that later. You know what? What I would say is this: as far as the stylistically from litigation, my perspective on it is that, you know, we'll be professional, we'll be courteous, we will treat with, you know, people with respect. However, pressure is what gets us paid. All right. You know, the old adage of, you know, we're going to all be friends here, and that's not how you get the best value for your cases. So it's not that we have to be mean to each other, but in terms of, you know, pressing buttons in litigation, my philosophy is, you know, bad faith is real. We will honor our, if we tell people we're going to, you know, not take the policy limits after a certain point, we're not going to. And, you know, our objective is to put them in such a pressure point that they, as I say, if they get in the way and settle the case, that's great. But you know, frankly, being a trial lawyer, a big part of that is every case you start at the beginning, you go stick the arrow in the bullseye, you tie a string around and you walk backwards to build a strategy for your case. And so many lawyers, I feel like, are always trying to get to some point in the case where they got their hand out that it just wreaks weakness. I just think you're better off building a plan, never mentioning settlement. If they bring it up and they want to mediate the case, then the case better be in a position that it can be settled appropriately. And we're going to have demands that are going to be required to be signed off on before we're willing to come to the table. So I guess maybe my friends at trial structure thought that was Rambo litigation. I just consider it as getting my client paid.
I love that because, you know, the ones thing I've seen, and you know, I've been doing this for a long time, over 20 years, is I have seen lawyers that I feel like didn't know, you know, what the end was, didn't have that in mind when they started. And, you know, ultimately, like you said, it's more handout at mediation versus, you know, saying, well, you know, you really don't know this case. You don't have it valued right, and walk out the door when the defense offers something, you know, that really isn't anywhere in the ballpark. Because it seems like that's what happens a lot of the time, and I think part of that might be of how that case happened to be positioned, you know, prior to the mediation.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people out there who look at my strategy. And that is my strategy. Make no mistake. Like, that's how I try to, if we're going to file a case and we're going to believe in it, we're going to go, that's the way we look at it. And I think people think when I talk about this that it's like, well, Brett must just not be in too big a hurry to get the case resolved. It's actually just the opposite. The more pressure we can mount, the less opportunity we have to have meaningless settlement negotiations and time spent that is meaningless and a waste of time. And so I like to get a trial date, work toward it hard. And if we mediate, we're not going to stop litigating, right? Because I think people, if they were to have a criticism of it, they're like, well, you know, that seems like a very, you know, you must not be in much of a hurry. And that's just not true. It's the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. And from what I've seen, lawyers that do take that kind of tack typically put enough pressure on the defense that, you know, if it's a case that's going to be settled, it'll get settled in a shorter time frame because of that pressure.
That's been my experience, you know, and I also believe that there are a lot of cases, the new strategy is that the defense comes to you early and asks whether you want to mediate the case. Well, why are they doing that? Three reasons. One, they want to gather information. Two, they want to have your client thinking about money for a long period of time in a way that when they get broke or when they have a tough time, they know that that's kind of dangling out there. All right. It's a way to sort of massage down the number. And number three, as far as I'm concerned, they want to put it in a position where, you know, they try to make it sound like they're trying to settle the case. And maybe that's true. But if you know you're not going to take a low offer, then there's really no reason to go. And all it does is, it traumatizes your client. That's my opinion.
Yeah, because they think that there's a possibility of getting resolution when really it seems to be more of a fishing expedition and or, you know, like you said, putting pressure on that client financially to think that they, you know, there's dollars that are going to come sooner when it may take a whole lot longer to really get the value extracted from the defendants because, you know, there needs to be more discovery for them to understand why they're going to lose a trial or they have a huge risk at trial.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not going to tell you there haven't been cases where things went worse for me. I mean, there are times where that happens, but sure. The large majority of the time you find information that they wanted to hide, that they were trying to bury. We're very aggressive with our, with our motions to compel and our good faith letters. You know, there's nothing to see here. It's not nothing to see here. There's too many times that I've been told that when I said, well, this is out of an abundance of caution. We're going to file the motion. We'll get an order. And all of a sudden, waha, there you go.
Yeah. Briefly, can you highlight a couple of important points about the trial lawyer associations that you're involved with, like Alabama Association for Justice, Southern Trial Lawyers, the State Bar, and why you're part of those organizations?
I'm a part of Texas Trial Lawyers, Georgia Trial Lawyers, Alabama Trial Lawyers, and the National and Southern Trial Lawyers as well. And look, there's the money part where you pay and they help our practice. I mean, they help keep us open. I mean, in Alabama, we're always under attack. Texas just took a major flurry of attack. So there's that part. And then there's obviously the parts that are great. It's the camaraderie. It's meeting new friends, meeting new people, new business contacts. It's just a great way to get together. And you know, I actually really like trial lawyers personally. My dad's a doctor. I'm not sure when I was growing up, he felt that way, but you know, I like them.
Agreed. I'm a member of FJA and AAJA and been a member of a lot of these different organizations over the years. I mean, what I find really cool, and I think trial structures somewhat of an offshoot of that, is just the way plaintiff lawyers help each other. You know, I see it on the listservs all the time. You know, typically plaintiff personal injury practices are smaller groups of lawyers. So having that larger group of lawyers, which basically is almost like being a part of a big firm because you've got all these people with resources, people that have done the research on a legal issue that you might be dealing with or, you know, dealing with some type of discovery related issue or whatever. Somebody's always willing to help out. The profession is just so cool about that sort of aspect of it that, you know, seeing that in the trial lawyer associations is really nice to see that.
I cannot imagine where I would be. I mean, by that, what I mean is I can only imagine that left to my own devices and without the help of so many, it would be an entirely different world. And, you know, and I say that You know, it took me, I've had mentors since day one, and they've been kind and they've been good to me, and it hasn't always been beneficial to them. And it's one of the things that I try to remember every day when I wake up is that, you know, to much is given, much is owed. And that's, you know, I really believe that that's a huge part of what makes, has basically allowed us, given us the ability to stand up to a lot of these corporate, you know, these companies and the insurance companies.
So that's a good segue into this question, which is really all about mentorship. And I'll limit it somewhat, but you can answer it however you like. What is one tip you would give to other trial lawyers that's been part of your secret to success in the practice of plaintiff personal injury law?
Never stop learning. And I have to say that there was a time, Jason, I remember it 5 years ago. Now I've been practicing 15 years. Okay. So, 5 years ago, I had tried about 10 cases a year, most of them, you know, car wrecks and whatnot, for about 2 years in a row. And I had my shtick down, buddy. I thought I was hot stuff. And I was winning the majority of the time, not nearly what I could have been now that I know now that I know more. And I got to a place where I kind of was just winging it. It's the truth. I got complacent. I decided I was hot stuff. And for one reason or another, I went to Jacksonville, Florida, and saw some people who I now own, Alejandro Blanco, who I now own Trial Structure with. And I went, okay. I was just blown away. And it was a lesson to me to continue to learn, and I still feel that way today. And the last 5 years it's been like, you know, a complete meteoric type of, you know, rise in the sense of my success. And also, and I attribute all of that to mentors and to continuing to try to learn and do new things.
Great advice. Wholeheartedly buy into it and constantly do things outside of synergy and outside of my law practice to try and get better as a leader and personally and, you know, as well as professionally. It's if you're not learning, then you're just going backwards. So great advice. So I know your firm is kind of unique, and you've got cases that you work on outside of Alabama, co-counseling cases. I'm just curious about what your plans are for your future for your law firm.
Right now, my law firm has an office in Birmingham, Alabama. It has an office in Atlanta, Georgia. We actually do just as much work in Georgia as we do in Alabama, if not more. We just hired our third lawyer there. I'm licensed in Texas. We're licensed in about 13 states. We practice all the United States. We have intentions of continuing to grow our Texas practice, and are working on a lot of Texas cases currently. Cases in the Midwest, but it's everything that's personal injury, everything that's catastrophic injury. We work on automotive product liability period, industrial accidents, nursing home, medical malpractice, obviously trucking, you know, really pretty much anything personal injury. And we do it all over the country. My plans for the firm is we're going to likely open some more offices. And the reason for that is that we can be a steward of that market and work with the lawyers there. I try to be a two-way street. There are cases that don't really fit the profile of cases that we're looking for, and we refer a lot of cases out as a result of that, that are sort of not, we're not really set up to handle volume. And so we're really built around, you know, cases that are, you know, perceived to be $1 million and up, and you know, all the way up to the top. There are also times where we're brought in just to try cases at the end, which is important, you know, an important piece of the puzzle. So that's what we're doing right now. I'm excited. We're growing fast, but most importantly, I feel just completely, I'm just blessed that we have so many great cases in here that we can believe in, wonderful clients that we have the opportunity to represent and continue to move this thing forward.
So last question wrapping up, and I do ask this of every guest, and admittedly it's self-serving, but curious as to what types of issues are arising commonly in cases when you're settling them, whether it's liens or Medicare or Medicaid preservation or, you know, trust or how the client manages the recovery. What are the most important issues that are coming up today in your cases?
You just covered it. I mean, and it's all of the above. The ability to have my clients keep their Medicaid is a major piece of the puzzle, and you guys are fantastic at that. Managing my clients' money after I shake their hand and they walk out the door of my office is an amazing. It's amazing to know that they're taken care of. And you know, you guys come in, and all of the things that you just mentioned are things that we see on the back end of these cases, primarily the bigger ones. But you know what? It could be anything. And you know, lien resolution is another. I was blown away with. I was like, you know, we've always negotiated our own liens. We don't really need help with that. And then we gave you guys a few cases, and I was like, okay, well, obviously, my clients are going to benefit from that. So I'm seeing all those issues arise. I think that. There's between, you know, I do a lot of brain injury, which obviously requires a lot of special needs trust help. And, you know, obviously we have the Medicaid trust and the things that you and I are always working on. But no, I think all the things that you mentioned are coming up and, you know, in a multitude of different ways. And here's the other thing. I don't want to have to do those things. I don't know how to do them. So if I can hand it off to you and your team and y'all just take the ball and go with it, that's great. And that's exactly what's happened so far.
Yeah, expecting a trial lawyer to be an expert in everything is like asking a trial lawyer to, you know, do guardianship work, do estate work, you know, do things that, you know, as a lawyer, you do have other lawyers or experts that come in and do. And that's why it's so important, I think, that, you know, we fill that void in, you know, the trial lawyer's team is having that kind of, you know, resource that can make sure that all those issues are dealt with in a way that the lawyer can close his case compliantly and doesn't have to worry about, you know, whether there was something missed when that file goes to storage. So great answer, really the perfect answer. So in wrapping up, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Sure. By phone, it's 205-831-5040. Again, 205-831-5040. bturnbull@turnbullfirm.com works as well. And again, we've offices in Birmingham, Atlanta, soon to be Texas, and practice all over the United States of America in personal injury.
And for our listeners, we'll put all that information on the webpage for this particular episode. So if you need to reach out to Brett, you'll have that at your fingertips. And thanks for tuning in to Trial Lawyer Review today. And thank you to Brett for being my guest.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to Trial Lawyer Review. You can find more at triallawyerreview.com and look for more episodes and more content coming in the future.